President Trump has released a Gaza peace plan that places Gaza under the control of a Trump-chaired board of peace. While some in the international community have welcomed the move, others have questioned the fact that it bypasses Palestinians and offers no path to statehood. So with Netanyahu vowing to not fully withdraw from Gaza, does this deal merely cement the status quo, or can it offer a true pathway to peace? This week on Upfront, I'll be asking that question to one of the foremost scholars on Israel-Palestine, Dr. Norman Finkelstein. Norman Finkelstein, thank you so much for joining me on Upfront.
Well, thank you for having me.
U.S. President Donald Trump this week released what he calls a Gaza ceasefire plan. The thing about the proposal, though, is that it was drafted without any participation from Hamas. There's no seeming pathway to Palestinian statehood. And it sets in place a board of peace that's chaired by Donald Trump to govern Gaza. How should we see this plan in terms of its credibility?
I think there are several things to be said. First of all, I do believe a historical context is important. Since Jimmy Carter, we're talking about the mid-1970s, every U.S. president, with the exceptions of Biden and Obama, every U.S. president has presented a Middle East peace plan that's supposed to bring achieve peace between Israel and the Palestinians. Now, the Trump so-called plan, I would say of all the plans, it's by a wide margin the flimsiest. Just as a factual matter, there's no reference to any documents. All the other ones will make reference to 242 and 338 and UN resolution this or that or some sort of international. Here it's nothing. It's just 20, it's literally just 20 points. There's no reference, no elaboration, no coherence, no nothing. There's only one deadline in the 20 points. There's one deadline. Hamas has 72 hours to accept it, or Trump is going to give the green light to decimate Gaza. Not that it's not already being decimated, but he'll give the green light. Apart from that, it seems to me that apart from that one deadline, I think it's a non-starter. Nothing is going to happen. So if you look closely at the things it says, forget about the issue of statehood. There's no context of statehood. But there is an issue of a genocide right now, in the here and now. So what does it say? First of all, it says that Israel will be able to decide whether or not to withdraw based on whether or not Hamas has been disarmed. If you look at point 16, if you have it in front of you, point 16 is very clear. Israel doesn't have to move an inch if it's in its opinion Hamas has not disarmed. Well, how do you prove Hamas is disarmed? Is there any way to prove that? So all Israel has to say is Hamas hasn't disarmed. Now, there are parts of the agreement which in theory, you know, sound wonderful, like UN organizations will have clearance to go in and would have to have as a minimum the amount of aid that was admitted with the ceasefire that began January 17th of this year. But then they have a provision. It's very subtle. It says UN organizations which are not partial to either side. Well, there goes UNRWA, because you already know UNRWA is a Hamas organization. That's what Israel has been saying.
Yeah, because based on the Israeli narrative, the UN itself is not an impartial institution, right? So who is an impartial institution?
I know. Well, it says has to be agreeable. It has to be impartial. Neither supporting one side or another. Well, that leaves all the UN organizations out. I think the bottom line is maybe Hamas will agree and give up the hostages. It's possible. I can't predict that sort of thing. Doesn't make any difference. First of all, Israel doesn't want Hamas to give up the hostages. That's just a factual matter. Because the hostages has done well in terms of PR. you know, because people abroad have no idea what's going on. So he said, well, why doesn't Hamas just free the hostages? That's all they have to do. But as a practical issue, it makes no difference at all. Because October 7th, it was a crisis for Israel. No question about that. Nobody should, you know, pretend as if Israel was a bomb behind it, a false flag. It was a real crisis. And it was, for them, a real calamity. No question about it. But people in power are very cynical, as you, of course, know. And there are a few salty tears shed, and then they rub their hands, the palms of their hands, in anticipation. What can we get out of it? And for Israel, this was a godsend. This was a godsend, October 7th. It wasn't just an opportunity. You know, the cliche, every crisis is an opportunity. It was a godsend. Because they have been trying to figure out how to solve this Palestine question. And if you look at the history from after 67, they've always been looking for opportunities. When can we carry out the expulsion? And it seemed as if it couldn't happen.
Let me ask you, is the end game here the consolidation of U.S.-Israel power in the Middle East?
No. The end game is the same game from day one, from October 8th. It's the same game. One of the things I found very striking, I just read the UN Commission of Inquiry report, which chaired by Navi Pillay, in which they conclude that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. And in order to demonstrate the allegation of genocide, you have to show intent. Okay, that they intend. And they start citing all of the statements that were made by senior Israeli officials right after October 7th. And you know what was the most striking thing about that? They said, Israeli officials said, we're going to reduce Gaza to rubble. That's the word they use. We're going to reduce Gaza to rubble. There are no civilians in Gaza. Everybody is Hamas. And all those things. So what was the standard response back then? The standard response was, they said it in the heat of the moment. They were traumatized. They were shocked. They were indignant. But guess what? You know what happened in the next 2 years?
Same thing.
Exactly what they said.
Yeah.
They reduced Gaza to rubble. They didn't distinguish between combatants and civilians. They reduced the population not just to starvation, but to famine. At least a quarter of the population, right as we speak now, is living in famine conditions. They stuck hard and fast by what they said they were going to do on October 8th. They didn't, obviously, sometimes political constraints set in. That causes you to adjust your program.
Right.
But not
fundamentally change.
Not abandon it. So, not to change it. Not to jettison it.
So then, does this plan help with that? I mean, is there anything in this plan that gives even a modicum of relief to Palestinian people, given the starvation, given the lack of access to resources, everything we've seen for the last 2 years of genocide? Does the plan offer anything?
Well, that really depends on Trump. If they release the hostages, I think they'll probably, you know, my guess would be there'll be a temporary period like there was that ceasefire that lasted for 2 months. And then Israel will find an excuse, a pretext. It's not hard to fabricate pretext. Or it will simply say Hamas hasn't disarmed. We gave them a chance to disarm. And then they will resume where they left off, as they resumed on March 18th of this past year. So there may be, I suppose, if Hamas releases the hostages, there may be a temporary period. But I don't say this with glee, and I don't say it because I'm stubborn. I say it because that's what the track record shows. Israel will not let go of this opportunity.
So
this is that godsend. and they will not let it pass.
Many Israelis, including some members of the Netanyahu government, have rejected even this deal, and they seem to want to continue the genocide in full force.
They all want to continue it in full force.
What does it say about Israeli society?
I think that Israeli society, I've said it for many years, I think it's a lunatic society. People try to avoid that fact. If you take somebody like Bernie Sanders, he started off terrible the first couple of months on Gaza, and then he got quite good. I had very little problem with him except for one thing. He kept saying the problem is Netanyahu.
Right.
The problem is Netanyahu. That's not true. Even Netanyahu made the point in his UN speech. He says, everybody blames me for not wanting a Palestinian state, he said in the UN speech. But he said, you know what? He said, last week, he said there was a vote in the Knesset whether you oppose or support a Palestinian state. He said there are 120 members of the Knesset. Do you know how many support the Palestinian state? He said, correctly, 9. Over 90% agree with me. The problem is not me. This is what we all agree on. That's true. Israeli society, a poll taken probably about 4 or 5 months ago now, showed that 47% of Israeli Jews, 47%, support a genocide in Gaza. It wasn't an ambiguous question. You said, well, genocide, you know, can mean many things. No. They were asked a very simple question. When the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, when they enter a city, should they kill everybody in the city? That was literally the question that was posed to them. Should you kill everybody in the city? 47% said yes.
That's a stunning number.
Then, a few weeks later, there was a question, because Israelis are the most polled people on earth. So a few weeks later, after that 47%, there was a question put to Israeli society in general. Are there any innocents in Gaza? Are there any innocents in Gaza? 62% said no. And then, if you factor out the 20% of Israelis who are not Jewish, it's a 70%.
Wow.
Say there are no innocents in Gaza from age 0 on up. No innocents in Gaza. Now, even if you read that latest UN report, which I mentioned, quite a lot of space in the report is given over to the Israeli targeting of children. Quite a few pages, very painful, hard read, the targeting of children. They target children in the head and in the chest, the skull and in the chest. The report says they target, I'm using the words, they target toddlers. They target toddlers. That's correct. So you have this sick look on your face as any normal human being. You know, you read stuff like that. And as Oprah would say, very hard for me to wrap my mind around that. No, really.
Yeah.
It's very hard. Not because I'm Jewish. Because I'm human. It's just very hard. But then you might say, okay, you know, probably exaggeration, and what are your sources, and you know, all that sort of stuff. But just a few months ago, a leader of the opposition in Israel, Jewish opposition, he said, our soldiers kill children as a hobby. As a hobby. You get it?
Yeah.
As a hobby. It's not a state project. The genocide is a national project.
Well, let me take that thought and extend it for a moment, because we have that history on the one hand, and then just recently we had Netanyahu issue a very rare apology to Qatar for the Israeli strike in Doha that killed one Qatari security official and violated, of course, the state's sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
Given this history you're talking about, given Israel's brazen disregard for international law and the appeals of, I mean, so many nations, not just in the Middle East, but around the world after this happened. Is this a significant development? Is this an aberration?
No,
Or is there something else to it?
I think what happened is, as you know, the Saudis were on board just before October 7th. The Saudis were on board to join the quote-unquote Abraham Accords.
Yeah.
And they wanted to join the Abraham Accords for a very simple reason. They feared what was called the Axis of Resistance led by Iran, and they thought that the Israelis and the Americans could pull their chestnuts out of the fire in case there's a conflict with the quote-unquote Axis of Resistance. So there were two developments since then. Development number one, the Axis of Resistance collapsed. Hezbollah is no longer a significant player. Iran was forced to absorb quite a lot of attacks by Israel and the United States and wasn't able to respond effectively. So the stake for the Saudis to join the Abraham Accords, it had diminished somewhat. The Axis of Resistance didn't prove to be as powerful as one might have assumed. But then there was a second thing. Israel was carrying on like a Genghis Khan, attacking Syria, attacking Lebanon, attacking Yemen, attacking Qatar. So I left out some Iraq. So now the Saudis are having second thoughts. Is this how Israel is going to treat us? Like a slave?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what we're going to get out of this Abraham Accord? That they are now transmitting the message, we will attack who we want, where we want, how we want. And unless you follow our marching orders, you're in our crosshairs. So the attack on Qatar, in my opinion, was going one step too far. And there had to be a message transmitted by Trump to Israel, cool it, because you're going to destroy everything for us. You're carrying on like so brazenly that it's going to jeopardize our grand plan for the Middle East, because as you know, Trump considers the Saudis the crown jewel. They can get them because it's real estate, for real estate and money. So I believe that Netanyahu was ordered by Trump to issue that apology because he doesn't want to lose the Gulf. And Israel was just carrying on too brazenly.
So just as we conclude here, what's your forecast for what the immediate future looks like?
I can't really predict. One thing I will predict, Israel will not let go. That is not going to happen. All of this talk about in that Trump plan, we want the Gazans to stay. It says we want them to stay. No. Israel is not going to want them to stay. We're going to rebuild Gaza and give a new happy life to everybody who stays. That's not going to happen. But what will happen, I think Israel will... I think there's a certain clarity of terminology that's required. Israel's goal, its objective, is to ethnically cleanse Gaza. That's its goal. It's using genocidal means in order to achieve that goal. It will kill as many people. The definition of genocide is the intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnic, religious,
or racial
group. So they're using genocidal means, but their objective remains to ethnically cleanse Gaza.
And I guess I wonder less about what Israel's plan is, because we know that. What does the world do? Does the world fall in line? Do they continue to have a blind eye? Do they actually form a resistance coalition? What happens?
Well, I'll try to end on a hopeful note. Not because I want to deviate from the facts. The facts, whether they're hopeful or not hopeful, the facts are what's most important. But I still think there are hopeful signs. I would say one thing that actually surprised me, and maybe I'm so desperate to see something positive, there was the court decision on Mahmoud Khalil and the others. The judge was, his name is Young, I think, and he was a Reagan appointee. He was so tough on Trump. He said that they're terrorizing people who are trying to exercise their free speech. And he says, why can't they exercise their rights of speech, but a much bigger group who are pro-Israel get to exercise their rights? He said, why was ICE putting on the masks? He said they look like the Ku Klux Klan.
Wow.
Yeah, he was tough. And
that gives you hope.
Is there any grounds for hope? Obviously, it's a fair question. First of all, we have to, in my opinion, we have to start from the basics. There's no silver lining in a genocide. This Trump plan was just totally detached from reality. We want the people of Gaza to stay. Stay where?
Right.
About at this point, as of two months ago, 92% of the housing was gone in Gaza. Now, that was before the demolition of Rafah and before the demolition of Gaza City. Now it must be 95% of Gaza. 95% of Gaza's housing is gone.
Yeah.
95%. The hospitals, 70% are gone. So stay where? Rubble. As of 2 months ago, it was estimated that there were 50 million tons of rubble in Gaza. It was estimated that it would take until the year 2050 to just clear out the rubble, because the rubble is mixed in with all this unexploded ordnance, and it's mixed in with toxic chemicals like asbestos. So it would take 100 trucks a day. It would take till 2050 to clear it out. Now, 2050.
Oof.
Now, after the destruction of Rafah and Gaza, it must be at least 60 million tons of rubble. So you have no connection between the reality of what's been done to Gaza over the 2 years and this plan. We want everybody to stay, but of course you want to leave. We'll help you relocate elsewhere.
This doesn't sound like the grounds for hope.
No, I don't see grounds for hope. I came across, I'm going to just see if I could find it. It was a good line. This was from Abraham Lincoln, his second annual message to Congress. We cannot escape history. It will light us down in honor or dishonor to the latest generation. We cannot escape history. It will light us down in honor or dishonor to the latest generation.
Wow.
So I take from that, at bare minimum, and I recognize it doesn't save any life, at bare minimum, we can preserve the historical record of what these people have done. And that, to me, is something. It's not going to save a life. I recognize that. But at least let the truth be preserved.
Indeed.
And that's what I do.
Norman Finkelstein, thank you so much for joining us on Upfront.
Well, thank you for having me.